This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of spoken word entertainment. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/twim. This week on the show, rabbit ears are making a comeback. Hollywood box office breaks records, and TSA is cutting into our in-flight viewing. Right here on This Week in Media, number 164. Hey everyone, welcome back to This Week in Media, and we've got a great crew. I'm very excited. This is it. This is the finale. This is the end. Now we don't have Daisy. Daisy's she's taking the week off. It's just, you know, it's the holiday. She's got family and she's just taking a little time off. But we do have Tim. Hey Tim, how's it going?
Hey, it's going well, Alex. Thanks for having me. Always good. A pleasure. I'm looking forward to this one too. We have some special guests.
Yeah, we have Tim went out into his deep network and got some very special guests here. We have Arthur Greenwald from Greenwald Media. Hey Arthur.
Hi there.
And you've been on before. I think the last time you were on was NAB. Is that right?
That's right. We were huddled around a coffee table talking into your cufflink or something.
Yeah, exactly.
Your backup microphone.
Exactly. So it's great to have you back. And also, we also have Shira Lazar.
Yes, you got it right. Hi.
Thank you very much.
Coming to you from Montreal.
You're in Montreal?
Yeah, for the holidays. It's my hometown.
How's the weather up there?
It's cold. It's snowy, but you know, it's a nice change from LA. So I'm happy. Last time I was actually at the cottage on Twit with Leo Laporte, and that was a lot of fun for people who watched it. No wine here, unfortunately.
No. So there's a, we try to keep it a little, you know, Leo can get away with that. And sometimes, I can't, I start to slur, it's one of those things I try to avoid. So we've got, it's great to have you on our show. And, now we've got some great stories, of course, to chat about here. First one up, AT&T website stops selling the iPhone in New York City. Tim, can you give us a little more information about this?
Yeah, apparently AT&T, the network, is not able to handle all the data requests in New York City. And so what they've decided to do instead is stop selling iPhones in New York City. And this comes to us from Mashable, but it's all over the place today. It's big news. Seems like a weird thing to do because people can just buy an iPhone someplace else. If you can't buy it in New York City, you can go buy it someplace else. It's not really going to solve the problem, at least from what I can see. It seems pretty crazy.
I don't even know what to say about that. I mean,
it should be April Fool's Day, but we're in the middle of the holiday.
Yeah. It's like, we weren't sure if there was going to be enough gas, so we decided not to put any tires on the car. It seems like this insane problem. But isn't this a problem that's starting to unwind for AT&T? I mean, this bandwidth issue that they're talking about, this data bandwidth. Now, I don't know whether they're posturing so that they can charge us more soon, or whether it's really a problem. But it just seems like it's unraveling. You know, their ability to manage the demand.
Hopefully, for me, I feel.
Go ahead.
I was saying, hopefully, it's a tipping point for it going to other carriers. Like I have Verizon, and it's really been frustrating. I mean, I also have an AT&T plan, so I can get an iPhone, but it's frustrating that it's only on one carrier. And hopefully, this proves that in the future they're going to have to. There'll be a balancing act, and it won't be just exclusive to AT&T.
I mean, in some ways, it's kind of insane that you're talking about one phone causing all the trouble. You almost have to share the pain of the iPhone around. But isn't this, Arthur, don't you think this is rather than just being the iPhone, this is really just a glimpse into the future?
Well, I think you're right. And I think that there's actually, if you want to be a conspiracy theorist, I think this is very possibly a deliberate PR ploy. Because as you probably know, February 17 is the deadline for the task force at the FCC to make their recommendations about where they're going to get additional broadband space. And the preliminary word is that they're going to try to force television broadcasters to give up part of their spectrum to turn more of it into broadband again. And that's very, very, very controversial.
Tim?
I just got a text from one of our viewers who says that they've just resumed iPhone sales in New York City.
Nice. Breaking news.
I see that we were able to bring down the TWIM hammer. And immediately after we began talking about it, they've now made it available again, yet again on the show. So it sounds like this was some kind of misstep. They were kind of going down that path, and the PR must have gotten a little further out of hand than they thought.
Yeah, apparently so. It'll be interesting to see how this one unfolds and who will be the next carrier for iPhone.
You have to imagine that Apple is just itching to get out of this contract at this point.
Dying. I mean,
they just, you know, AT&T doesn't, whether AT&T can handle the bandwidth or not, they obviously can't handle PR very well. And so I think that's their, you know, beyond any of the other technical problems, I think that's another problem. Speaking of problems, of course, we know we had some crazy news over the weekend. Someone tried to set himself on fire inside of a Northwest flight. I guess he was trying to blow himself up, but it turned out just to set himself on fire. And he needs to learn that PETN needs to be compressed before it will burn in a volatile nature. So the anyway, this could change the security rules and limit in-flight laptop time. And this is something that's actually very important to me. Tim, can you give us a little more information?
Sure. It seems like the big rule here is that the last hour of the flight is going to be the sit still and act pretty hour on any flight. And so you'll have to put away any electronic devices and just sit there. Hopefully you'll be able to read a book, but I don't think you'll be able to listen to your iPhone and listen to any books on Audible.
Do we know how this actually affects the safety of the plane, or is it just to make us feel safer?
But it's so ridiculous. And no, this just makes people more nervous. It makes them pretend like they have control over us, where people can, you know, whip out a bomb in the middle of a flight. It's like the beginning or the end, really, does it matter? I think this is just a way to like make us more anxious about something else and to make them have more control.
Maybe,
personally.
And maybe feel like something's being done.
Because,
yes, you know, the reality is that with the current security, I mean, I think what this proved more than anything else, that the current security is actually pretty good. The guy couldn't get something on that effectively was going to blow up. You know, he did get something on, but, you know, he was a long way from doing.
Well, they needed to react in a certain way, and I don't think they really knew what that would be. So this was the easiest way for them to create some sort of structure or some sort of, you know, a code of control for passengers, because, you know, many people are obviously flying because of the holidays. I don't know if it's really going to matter. If someone wants to blow up a plane, unfortunately, my dark perspective is they'll do it. It won't matter if they can whip out whatever electronic device at the beginning or at the end.
Yeah, so it's and it may be it now. It's also a lot of it is because what it's actually saying, just to make sure we're talking about the same thing here, is new rules imposed. This is in Air Canada's website. New rules imposed by the U.S. Transportation Security Administration also limit onboard activities by customers and crew in U.S. airspace that may adversely impact onboard service. Among other things, during the final hour of flight, customers must remain seated, will not be allowed to access carry-on baggage, or have personal belongings or other items on their lap. And so that's, you know, so theoretically, I mean, I don't know where my iPhone comes into this, you know, whether I can actually continue to watch a movie because it's not on my lap. And I didn't access it. It was in my pocket. But I mean, these are the kind of things that are going to be the arguments that you're going to have on flights, you know, with people who are, a lot of us have gotten into a very deep pattern of how we actually manage this. And so and I think how it affects media in some respects is beyond electronics is that there's a lot of people creating businesses around, you know, what you can do on flight, on air, you know, online Wi-Fi and, you know, or in-flight Wi-Fi and so on and so forth. And this could turn into a big mess, you know, for a lot of people that have invested a lot of money, you know, in this process.
And
you were gonna say?
And it could delay. I mean, you know, a lot of us thought, you know, we'll be connected more and more obviously in the future. And in 2010, with a lot of the flights this year, putting Wi-Fi on, you know, in the air. But now, yeah, if you have a 90-minute flight and you're not even allowed to whip out your laptop, it does affect many things and what we thought the future could hold, I guess, in flight.
Yeah. So we'll see. So, you know, once again, some idiot ruining for everybody. Hey, before we go any further, I just want to, of course, thank our sponsor. Today's broadcast, of course, is brought to you by Audible.com. It's a leading provider, of course, so we've all heard this, of spoken word entertainment. Now, Audible has over 50,000 titles to choose from to be downloaded, and you can play them back anywhere. I mean, you don't need to stream them or wait for them to be available. You can just download them, throw them on your iPod, throw them on your iPhone, throw them on whatever you want to listen to, and just play them back. And I do this a lot. As many of you know, I'm slowly working my way through The Glass Castle, which is really good. Another one that is really great, and I think that I'm just having fun with. I've always been a big fan of Howie Mandel, and he came out with a book, which he is actually narrating, which is Here's the Deal, Don't Touch Me. He's a little bit of a germaphobe. And I don't know why I find it entertaining, but I do. And I just find listening to Howie Mandel entertaining. So, and this is a great thing that not only do you get to read it, of course, you get to listen. To someone kind of go off that's fun to listen to. So anyway, I love it. I mean, I think a lot of you already know that I'm a little bit of a little obsessive about, I listen to books. That's what I do. A reference, maybe I'll have a printed book, but that's about the only time you're going to catch me with a printed book is reference. You know, if I'm going to listen to something linearly from the start to the finish, I don't want to be a unitasker. I want to be able to do something else while I'm bringing all that information in. So anyway, check it out. If you don't like that book, you can get anything. If you haven't done this already, you can go to audiblepodcast.com/twim. That's audiblepodcast.com/twim and get a free audiobook. So if you haven't gone up there already, get your free audiobook. Pick that one. Pick the Howie Mandel one. Pick whatever you want. It's really worth checking it out. It's just the way. It's the future. Anyway, audiblepodcast.com/twim. Also, holiday box office breaks records, and I think we kind of felt like this might be coming, but Tim, can you give us the numbers?
Well, it looks like Avatar, you know, went back on top, and
so, by the way, Avatar dropped only 3%. Does that seem insane to you? That's just like an insane number from week to week, isn't it?
Yeah, estimated 75 million from 3,400 theaters, I guess, to bring in. I guess its total right now is 212 million, and
I believe that's overseas. I think it's like over 600 million, right?
Yeah, it's looking that way. Pretty amazing stuff, and a lot of people are also talking about Avatar really changing. Being a game changer in terms of the 3D, that, you know, will people only want to see 3D movies now is the chatter that I'm hearing from people. And, you know, I mean, will people want to watch movies in color?
Did you see it?
I don't know.
Did you see it?
Well, you know, Juno in 3D. I don't know if we needed to see, like, her popping out that baby in 3D. I think it's going to be appropriate.
Yeah, but you're taking it from a novelty standpoint. If it's just part of the technology that we get used to, the way that we're used to color television, it doesn't matter, you know?
I think that's the next step. It's like, you know, things like that, like a DVD or a CD, like things that were more of a luxury or part of a storyline become just more part of how we watch and, you know, as part of the experience. I think it's definitely in the future. I don't think it's going to be tomorrow, though.
Well, here's the question I have for the Juno question specifically is, why do you go to see a movie like Juno or Sideways or, you know, a lot of these movies in the theater? Like, what's the selling point? I think this is one of the things that 3D and IMAX is, in a lot of ways, is kind of attacking, is what is the selling point for going to the theater? I mean, I have a big screen at home.
I have two, actually.
It's the shared experience.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think it's the shared. It's also the water cooler. These are water cooler movies where it's like you want to feel part of the conversation the following week. Also, a lot of these movies possibly are nominated, and so they're not maybe on DVD or available to watch at home before they maybe reach, you know, the award shows. So you want to feel part of it, feel part of the excitement, understand why they're being nominated.
Arthur?
And you can't really enjoy popcorn unless it costs $75 a box. So.
Well, and I have to admit that that's one of the challenges for me is that I don't really like the popcorn. I don't like the drinks. I don't really like the other people that are in the theater most of the time. And so
that's a whole other issue. That we could talk about that in the therapy session of the show.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, interestingly, I thought the other technology that where they sort of buried the lead in Avatar was the marvelous advances in motion capture technology, where they really captured nuances of the actors' performances in the animation at a level that we've never seen before.
We have seen it, but not by many. I mean, we haven't seen it in a whole movie. I mean, a lot of that stuff was being done. A lot of that was pioneered through Gollum, you know, and through, you know, when we really saw that was where that really, and I believe, if I'm correct, I believe that a lot of Weta did a lot of that character work from the some of the groundbreaking stuff. They really built a lot of new technologies that made that possible. And so but this is the first time we've tried to do it with everybody. You know, that's an incredibly huge lift. And as someone who has, and we have a motion capture system at the office, and so we do a fair bit of motion capture in ours. Don't,
but you just use
ours doesn't look anything
for
like that.
Conference calls, right?
Yeah. I mean, doesn't everyone have a motion capture system for the conference calls?
Yeah, I do, yes. But I have to mention, there's something to be said about the fact that it took James Cameron 5 years to make this.
Not really realistic
to go, you know, for every movie, one, to spend this amount of money. People just don't have it in their budget. And the storylines aren't powerful enough to put the budget and the time into it. So you're always going to have movies that take maybe a year or less, or maybe 2 years to make. And so I don't think every movie will go into this category all the time.
Obviously. I completely agree. The question that I always get into, though, is that I literally now make decisions about what I want to watch at home and what I want to watch in the theater. And if it's a romantic, I'm sorry to say, but if it's a romantic comedy or if it's an artsy film, I generally want to watch that with my wife at the house and not bother. You know, the only time I bother to go to the theater is when it's going to be either cinematic. It doesn't have to be special effects, but it has to be a big feeling film, a Terrence Malick film I'm going to go see in the theater.
Yeah. And you know what? Those are the movies, though, that aren't making this amount of money. I mean, a good example of a movie that crowdsourced kind of like the theaters was that, what was the scary movie recently? Paranormal Activity.
Right.
They did it in an interesting way where they got people to nominate their theaters to bring in the movie. And I wonder if that's going to be what we see in terms of more independence. Like, you need to go to the theater and say, like, hey, can you bring this in? And if they get enough people, they'll bring the movie into that theater.
Right. It's going to be interesting. I think that's going to be the big challenge there. But it was exciting to see that it was a record weekend. And I think that just had to do with some great stories, you know, some great things put together. Now also we have Rabbit Ears making a comeback. Tim, what is Rabbit? Why are we using Rabbit Ears?
Well, it looks like, you know, especially this story comes to us from Los Angeles Times, and it's about how with digital television sets, people are now dropping their cable companies to save money and enjoying all the extra channels that they can get by using rabbit ears on their digital TVs. It's pretty simple. You know, I'm kind of wondering what other services are going to swing this way as well. I mean, people are getting tired of being nickel and dimed for every new service that they get. And I think that gives a huge advantage to companies that want to provide stuff for free with advertising. And this is a great example of how what's old is new again.
This also gets back to the broadband issue, because that's one of the things that those frequencies are being used for, the new digital channels that were just recently assigned to the broadcasters, both for regular and for mobile video. And it won't be long before TVs will be getting much better signals because of the translation signal that's encoded in the mobile signal will improve that rabbit ear reception, so that it becomes much more possible to just survive off the rabbit ears and get all kinds of extra channels on your home TV.
But are people really watching? I mean, I guess, sorry, I live in Northern California, so you're always like, do people really watch the television? Like, I mean, do they watch the broadcast channels? I mean, I guess they are. I mean, there's obviously still millions of people doing
actually
it.
Actually, people that go to their job, they punch a time clock, and then they get home and they just want to do nothing.
We're a minority. We forget we're not the majority. I mean, even I, you know, I work in TV, so I like to sometimes go on and put on live TV, like the cable news channels, or I like to watch, you know, the shows like on Showtime and HBO in live time. There's something, it's a novelty. And I think there's something special about that. So while I can't download it, I have Apple TV. I like the choice of being able to watch something in live time if it's happening, or just go to it whenever I want.
I mean, but do you feel the need to do that when you're watching anything other than news and sports?
No, unless it was like, the finale or the premiere of a show or an award show. Those are the things I like watching live. But that will change. You know, we'll be able to get access to those shows probably online. They'll stream it live. If the networks are smart, they would do both. They would do bundle packages for sponsorships. They would say, hey, you can catch it live online. If you have a TV, you can catch it there. Because they think that one is stealing the audience, you know, from the other, when they're just two separate audiences that watch and consume media in two different ways.
Because I have to admit, I watch award show, if I watch an award show, which I don't do very often, I tend to watch it 30 minutes behind. And by the end
of it, it's vastly more people. I'm sorry, was I interrupting that?
Nope, go ahead.
Vastly more people are watching broadcast television than are watching broadband video. I think we're sort of saying the same thing. And we tend to forget that a lot of the technologies that give us give broadband an advantage, the ability to watch what you want when you want, are migrating to broadcast in various ways. Not only are those programs going to be available, as Shira suggests, in a variety of consumer choices, but you'll have much more control over what you DVR, and conversely, the television stations and networks are starting to get credit for what you watch on your DVR, so it counts towards ratings and ad revenue. So this stuff is all merging in a way that will eventually balance out, and we won't be having this conversation of broadcast versus new media. It will all be media.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, and I think one of the interesting things we've talked about in the last couple episodes is the fact that with YouTube going to 1080p, I mean, you're really looking at the same resolution, whether it's web, TV, or film. You know, you're looking at 1920 by 1080, and so it's, we really are looking at that convergence where it's just really make it once and then just to, you know, figure out how people want to get it. Also in the news, we have Southland viewers are finding they can get nearly three times as many channels as they once could with an antenna. And so that's a little bit about what we were talking about before. So a lot of the stuff is becoming more available. Now, after that, or beyond that, we have cross-owned combos get yet another waiver. So, Tim, can you give us what does this mean?
Sure. I'm hoping Arthur can weigh in on this a little bit. But apparently what's going on is
what is a cross-owned combo?
Companies that own both a local broadcast and a print media company in the same geographic area are getting 90 days of a time waiver to keep them up and running. This seems to be an ongoing story that deals with a cross-ownership rule where the FCC doesn't want somebody owning both the entities. I mean, the studios and the networks have become these big media companies because there used to be rules in place that made it so that you couldn't own a network and stations and print media companies. And
of
so
course, the fear was really just monopolization of what people know.
Well, it was also a freedom of speech issue where you don't want somebody controlling the entire voice of what gets out there to the United States or to specific markets. Arthur?
Well, that's very well said. I think, of course, I guess when these rules were originally imposed, it was visions of Citizen Kane arising and telling people what to think. But, of course, now we've seen with mega mergers like the Tribune Company, which owns both KTLA, which has been an independent station, now it's a CW station here in Los Angeles, and the Los Angeles Times, both are struggling because the CW is not doing as well as it was originally hoped in prime time, although their local news is doing quite well. But the Los Angeles Times, like all major newspapers, has taken tremendous advertising hits in a technology that's still reinventing itself as rapidly as possible. So many people feel that these cross-ownership rules are really not useful anymore and, in fact, are harmful to newspapers more than anyone else.
How are they harmful to newspapers?
Well, because the combined efficiencies of a large media company that can supplement the coverage with, by say, running the feature stories about food or movie reviews in more than one newspaper and do the same trick on air with a chain of television stations, they can keep an operation running and profitable more than a purely independently owned local newspaper, which is especially struggling. Right. So like any other media consolidation, there's a hope of more efficiencies. Of course, it also means more job layoffs after the merger takes place.
Where you go to a lot of these local sites and it's just wire services. They're getting all the information dumped from their main hub. And so, yeah, it takes away employment from so many people and it takes away that, you know, that individual, that person creating content. So there is a problem here. However, a lot of these smaller companies wouldn't even kept up or stayed alive if it wasn't for the bigger ones buying them out at a certain point.
Right. So we'll see how that progresses. It does seem like it's not as important as it used to be to not have these things merge. Now, also in the news, we have consumer groups lobbying the FTC to block Google's acquisition of AdMob, so that people are starting to try to slow Google down a little bit. Tim, can you give us a little more information?
Sure. So AdMob is this company that started doing ads on the iPhone. And they were doing a great job. They got out there. They got distributed on a lot of different apps. A lot of free apps have AdMob on it. And then one day, all of a sudden, those ads stopped being AdMob ads, and they started being Google ads because Google had bought AdMob. And there are a couple of consumer groups that feel this is a bad thing, that Google's taking over too much of the space, and they're trying to shut them down. So that's pretty much the story.
So do we think that Google is taking up too much of the space? Does it really matter? Is there still enough opportunities for someone to find another way to do this?
I think there is, and you know, I've drank the Google Kool-Aid, so I kind of like that they bought AdMob. But
well, I know I find that as someone, we don't do a lot of advertising, but we're looking at doing more advertising in 2010, and I will say that I'm kind of glad that there's one place that I can go. I know that at some point in time, I might not be glad that there's only one place I can go, but I'm glad that there's one place that I can. It's mostly me just deciding how I'm going to impact that market, not, you know, trying to figure out the six different avenues to do it.
Yeah, there's too many places. I mean, I feel like there's so many options these days. So it's nice to see like one kind of go-to home where you know you'll be taken care of and you know you'll get results. It makes it easy. However, yeah, I'm sure once, you know, one person has an issue, it'll be hard to see other options after that. And that's where we find that problem, you know, like the story we had before on a small level, it used to be a problem. Now it's not. This is kind of the next level of that.
Right. So it'll be interesting to see how it works. Now, also, finally, I mean, we're running through these pretty quickly here, but our last story here is why are studios continuing to crank out remakes despite the flops? So studios are continually putting out these, you know, this is the background here, a little bit of background here. They're bringing back the Rockford Files. ABC is looking at Charlie's Angels. There's a new development, Hawaii Five-0. These are all coming out despite the fact that most of the stuff that has come out as remakes, like Melrose Place, I believe Knight Rider, all have been struggling a bit. If they are struggling, was it just that they were they came out and they were popular at a certain time? Has Hollywood just run out of new ideas?
What's interesting about those shows is that they're all 70s shows.
Right.
And, you know, you wonder what demographic they're targeting by reviving those particular shows. Knight Rider was a little later, so arguably that's still hitting what advertisers consider the sweet spot. But these are pretty much boomer appeal shows at this point. And so that's an interesting choice. Also, certainly in the case of Charlie's Angels and the Rockford Files, those were very dependent on the popularity of the stars of those shows. So right. It's going to all be about casting if they succeed in reviving those.
So basically bringing in a non-name or not a really, really strong actor to do this is going to be difficult. You know, that's the thing, is a lot of these were very based on the characters, and probably one of the reasons they were successful, right, was because of the characters, not because of the structure of the show. And maybe that,
well, sure.
Do we think that's what's missing?
Well, from a studio point of view, the thing that's so attractive about this is that from a marketing standpoint, there are a lot of people that are already familiar with these brands. They have brand equity. And so if you're going to market something and say, hey, it's, you know, the Rockford Files, there's a bunch of us older people who are like, oh, yeah, I remember that show. And then the next thought is, well, who's going to play Rockford? And, you know, from a development standpoint, there's a lot less work to do. From a story standpoint, there's a lot less work to do. And the marketing is really easy because of that.
So from a banker in Hollywood's perspective, this makes sense.
It seems to make sense. It never seems to succeed. It's like,
well, that's why you keep going for the hot model chick in Hollywood, and it's the same thing over and over again. It's like, that's what Hollywood's all about, going for the same thing that it looks good on paper. And, you know, execs are probably a bit old school dealing with the new people in development that are coming in. It's like, this works for everyone. The older demographic will like it because it feels, you know, they're familiar with the brands. And then the newer, younger, you know, audience will say like, oh, what, it's a new show. And they'll probably get like young, hot new actors to play it. Also, just like Tim said, the buzz is created. Like, the buzz is already there with these shows. Like Melrose Place and 90210, they did work on it, obviously, the PR campaign around it. But it created its own buzz because people were just so excited and wondering what these shows would be like, and, you know, who the new stars were, because a lot of these shows, you know, they create stars out of the people they just hire, just from hiring them. It's like they're followed by the paparazzi. They become like the new Hollywood jewels.
Well, and they have been successful. I mean, one successful one that was Battlestar Galactica turned out to be a huge success in rebuilding it, compared to the, I think it actually did much better than the original, but I think that might be part of the charm of this, is that the original had an audience for it that really existed after it already went off the air. I mean, it was more of a cult following for Battlestar Galactica, I think, than an actual following. Same with Star Trek to some degree, when they actually brought it back.
Well, as the New York Times article pointed out that wrote up this story, it's worked very well in the movies, originally with the Star Trek films, but also Mission Impossible, The Brady Bunch, and most recently Get Smart, with more on the way. And they brought in some pretty high-powered creative teams to be working on these revivals, more so than some of these restarts in recent years. So we'll see what happens.
Now, do we think that Hollywood's just running out of steam, or are they just in a rut?
Well, I mean, it really boils down to money. I mean, you know, you're competing against everything, and you need to develop shows in a least expensive way possible. And you need hits. And so you can do a reality show, or you can come up with a drama that nobody's ever heard of, or take something off the library shelf and resurrect it. And I think that's what's, you know, they're going to try it.
Well, I think isn't one of the dangers here though is that you get so driven by the model that you have a hard time, you know, opening it up to anything new. I know that one of the things that I think works about, my wife and I were talking about why we watch so much Law & Order, which I don't know if everyone watches a lot of Law & Order, but it is like, so I have all the Law & Orders on Netflix, you know, on my Netflix instant play. And whenever I just feel like I don't want to think, I just queue up in Law & Order and I watch Law & Order. I mean, that's why I do it now. What's important about Law & Order that's different about than a lot of the other police stuff to me is that it's not personal. There's like, you get hints of people's personal background of all the players, but it is not about who's, you know, it's very rarely who's sleeping with whom and all these relationships and all this stuff that was so part of the model. There's another show that I thought was going to turn out well, like called The Unit. We got all these special forces guys, and it turned into such a soap opera, I stopped watching, and so did everybody else.
Well, that's the thing. This generation, I'm sorry, there's a phone ringing.
Yeah.
This generation, though, is all, we grew up on reality TV. We are into the storylines, the dramatic storylines. I read actually an interesting article in Newsweek about celebrities versus people that are famous. And I think our generations crave the celebrity storyline, and that includes more of, you know, a storyline about their real life. It has nothing to do with who they are professionally. I mean, that kind of adds a little flair and accessory to their brand. But I mean, Angelina Jolie and Brad Pitt, we know them more for their life than their last movie they were in, which I'm sure a lot of us might not even know what movie that was. So I think that now definitely translates into new shows that we're seeing, I mean, and, you know,
that was a good slip.
Like, a lot of these shows also get a lot of heat because they bring them back, and it's like, people expect, they have such high expectations,
right,
that it's interesting that the network feels the need to bring them back, because it's like this dichotomy. It's easy. It's an easy sell. The PR buzz is like already there for them. However, when they're brought on air at first, it's like they're put under the spotlight, and a lot of people give them a lot of crap if it doesn't live up to expectations, or to, you know, where we saw it leave off, like a Charlie's Angels. We have great, you know, when we think of a Charlie's Angels show, it's like we have great thoughts of it right now, and it's like they could ruin these brands that all of us came to love.
Right.
Well, you know, it's funny, Alex, you mentioned The Unit. I happen to know some of the people who worked on that, and that was a show that changed in direct response to intensive audience research. And Hollywood isn't waiting for sequels to be made anymore to change the pattern of a show. You know, you've got several shows that are currently on the air that are brand new, like V and Flash Forward and recently canceled Dollhouse, that were basically either between seasons or put on hiatus in the middle of a season for the sole purpose of retooling the show and changing the character focus or the storytelling method a little bit. So when Flash Forward comes back, it's going to be slightly different and more streamlined, supposedly.
Supposedly, you're right. Yeah, you know, as I said, what I was kind of referring back to, you know, is the thing like with The Unit. I think most people who started watching that show, I think one of the problems that they had, or one of the things that they watched, is all we needed to watch was the missions. Like, we didn't really care about what their home life was like. You know,
but
most
the research told them the opposite.
Well, the research of the demographic they were trying to get a hold of, and when they changed it killed it. You know, because
then you have shows, and now you look at all these vampire TV shows. Now it's like Twilight came out, and we're like, mm-hmm. wow, we need to have vampire TV shows. And they're actually.
We need a vampire game show. That's what we need. I want a vampire game show.
Tim, that's a good idea. I think we should do that. It's like
I think some of us would say reality shows already suck, so I don't know that you need vampires.
But wow.
Yeah. So it'll be it's going to be interesting to see, you know, where Hollywood goes with this. I mean, I think that part of it's also just grappling for a large enough audience. I think that they're obviously still the biggest game in town, but when you're, you know, that any numbers you're looking at, they're sliding, and so trying to figure out how to do it more for less.
But it's also, again, it's a time of panic and transition, and these media models and these business models are still emerging. You know, the distinction between traditional and so-called new media, or more digital choices, is still being shaken out. That's in fact what we're all grappling with at the various conferences we're working on. But, you know, NBC, for example, rolled the dice and put Jay Leno on five nights a week, and they're taking a lot of heat for that now because it doesn't appear to be working out.
It's not apparent to work out. I think it sounds like it's disastrous. I mean, it sounded like that's what pushed the sale.
However, from a money making standpoint, it's not as disastrous as it's been portrayed, but it's certainly not good. Had it worked, however, which was an equal possibility when they tried it, these people would be hailed as geniuses.
Shira, what were you going to say?
Well, I'm just saying that I think the numbers that we've always expected from the past few years from, you know, previously from Jay Leno and all that, maybe we're just realizing they're just not attainable. And so we're expecting something that's just not there anymore in terms of the viewers. I mean, if you look at the amount of people watching, it's like 7 million or so. Those are still big numbers, but it's just what they're accustomed to is up here and what they're getting is down here. I mean, even Conan O'Brien's not doing well. So what's the answer? Do you change the spots? Is it about the timing, or is it just about the audience is displaced and we're wanting something new? I mean, you see a show like Chuck, which is on TV, and the whole thing is that they're doing social content is the big thing for 2010, where now they've created a whole experience online. We need to see more of that crossover, perhaps, and realize that they can't just expect all their engagement to happen from the show airing 1 hour a day. There needs to be much more put into it.
Well, and I think that, you know, the audience interaction, I do think, is important. I know my wife watches So You Think You Can Dance. She used to be on a TV show dancing. So she
you
like,
and your wife. I feel like we know about all your.
I'm sorry. That's I don't have any friends. I don't hang out with anybody.
I'm joking. I'm a single chick.
But she
What show was she on?
She was on Kids Incorporated when she was.
No way.
Yeah. So she was in the background. So she was one of the background dancers in Kids Incorporated. And so anyway. But she watches it like I watch football. You know, I wasn't that good at football. But anyway, but she knows everything that she's looking at, and she can tell you what all the, you know, where they didn't put their feet down and everything else. She votes on all that stuff. She calls all those votes in. She watches that thing, and she has to watch it live because she wants to be part of the voting, and she wants to do all the stuff. And it's like an event for her, you know, to watch that. And I think that there is something, no matter how silly I think the show is, there is something that is particularly powerful about having the audience get some way to interact. I don't know how you expand that to narrative, but it is a lot of these shows. I mean, part of what's making them so successful is that people feel like they have some power in how it's going to end.
And not having, you know, the host just talk at you, but make you feel part of the experience. I mean, we don't want to see a play or a theater act every single day. And I think that these shows like Conan or Jay, they're, they've always based their shows on that. And that's just part of the past. And as personalities, they need to find, yes, like you said, that extra way to engage, maybe more so in real time. And, you know, but in terms of ratings, even American Idol, every season it looks, the audience drops. I mean, they did have their, I think their big numbers with Adam Lambert and that whole controversy this year, but we're always going to see that, like, it, every time there's that little drop, people are going to go up in arms, because I think once again, we've always set our sights so high and the numbers have always been so huge that we're seeing the change. And so
sure. Like, I mean, even our chat room, we went from 391 to 390 people in the chat room right now.
We've gone down while we were talking. Yeah. I think that was mostly my fault.
And maybe we should like track why every time we talk about something, like they went down.
But you know, if we were covered in the trade press the way traditional media is, the headline tomorrow would be "This Week in Media Trends Down." I mean, it's that
they don't
kind
look at it as a relationship. That's why they don't look at it as a relationship. They look at it as it's numbers. There's money at stake, advertisers. And I think the reason, you know, they look at then us and what we do, and I act like we're another society or something. And they go, yeah, they're doing innovative stuff, but we're not getting necessarily the numbers that TV gets, but we have a direct relationship with the people watching. And so is it about going more mass, you know, in terms of relationship, or more niche?
Right.
And will advertisers realize the importance of both?
Yeah, and I think that it's, you know, for me, the show that I probably watch more than anything else is Alton Brown's Good Eats. And I don't...
Hey,
you know,
I'm with you on that. That's a great show.
I don't really cook that much either. I just watch it.
He's a really
fun.
Nice guy. I like.
Is he?
Yes, he's very nice.
I really want to meet Alton
Brown. I did some kitchen giveaways for Food Network, and I got to work with him and Bobby Flay and Paula Deen, and he was great. I mean, well, they all were, but he was cool.
Well, and I think that the interesting thing is that there is something that you, if you watch it long enough, there's something you feel like you have a relationship with him, even if you don't. Like, you've never met him, you never talked to him, you never gone to his website, but he's so personable about what's going on. And of course, when I went out, we were talking about this. I a lot of the stuff that's in my kitchen is based on seeing stuff at Good Eats, and there's something about creating that relationship that I think is. From an advertising perspective and from product placement perspective, and one of the things you know is that it's not product placement. Like, well, you assume it doesn't seem like people are paying him to put stuff in there. It really feels like he makes all those decisions on whatever geeky thing he thinks is.
Also,
is right.
If you look at all these Food Network personalities, they bring their relationships from on TV to offline, and yeah. I think that's where you build stronger relationships and a stronger audience. You know, they have books, they have food books, they're at conferences, conventions, they're out and about. Like, I've seen Paula Deen before. You never see Conan or Jay Leno off TV.
Right.
And I think the new personalities are going to realize that they can't rely just on their TV shows for everything. They need, you know, they need to extend beyond that.
Well, I think you also have to look at the difference in scale. You have Conan O'Brien and Jay Leno who are on 5 days a week. And doing something like 5 to 10 times more shows than any of the people on the Food Channel who do a limited number of shows that get repeated to death. It's a very different workload. And part of the business model for Food Channel is allowing for those personal appearances.
Well, and
part of the plan.
I think the model for both, the model for Food Channel, Travel Channel, and Discovery Channel, I mean, they're all kind of related to some degree, is that they have figured some of that stuff out. And they very quietly become extremely big players in the cable market. I mean, I think that a lot of people don't realize how big those channels are. But they are, I think that, I believe, is Discovery still privately held? I believe it is.
Yes.
And so that's one of the reasons we don't notice it, is because they don't have to make quarterly reports. They don't have to talk to us about stuff. They don't have to. But that is one massive corporation. I mean, and I've seen them grow. I mean, I have had the opportunity to visit a couple times, and you know, you've seen them grow from when they were spending $30,000 or $50,000 on a per unit, you know, on a 22-minute show, to, you know, spending $10 million on an hour show or something like that. You know, it's just a whole on some of the dinosaur stuff and stuff that they did, and they've really expanded, and even the base quality of what they're doing now. If you go back 10 years when they were still experimenting, but they kind of organically found their way there, and all of them have, I think, in that group. And I think that is, to me, when I look at what I want, the kind of stuff I want to create, you know, or the kind of stuff that I'm interested in as far as content or what might work well on the web, those are the channels that I tend to look at.
Really?
Yeah, those are, but I'm an info geek, So I, you know,
what is that to be said though? That's like what he said, how those are evergreens. They shoot them over 2 months and then they have the whole year to basically do a PR blitz around it. What is then the model in terms of like a daily show where you need to be around daily, you know, ramping out content? How can you make that so it's engaging?
You know, and the thing is that I, you know, like an Alton Brown, for instance, I sit there and when I turn it on, I, you know, at 5 o'clock in the afternoon, I know that when I go on there, well, maybe that's one I haven't seen yet. And it's hard to get the old versions for some reason. It's hard to get the old discs that have like all of them. So I don't have all of them. And so, oh, I didn't see the one that was recorded in 2002 and I don't have any need for it to be new. You know, it's like, and so that's the, I mean,
you're the kind that watches your movies over again too, though.
You know. That drives my, I'm not going to say it, but it drives people who live around me get a little crazy because I can watch the same. It's not even that I watch the same films over again. I watch the same parts of the film over and over again. So it's,
you actually have to spend that time fast forwarding.
No, that's what DVDs are for. In fact, if you're really good at it, you rip them and then you just cut out the part that you want and then you keep it on the DVR that way. So it's only the part that you want. Tim, did we miss anything?
The only thing I think we could add is that we do have some shows coming up if people are interested. I don't know when this one will hit the air in terms of the podcast, but we do have CES. You're going to that, yes?
Yes. So are we all going to CES?
I am.
I'm not. I won't be there.
Tim. Well, Tim.
I know.
You have to come.
But I'll be. I need to find a reason to go.
Well, here's your reason.
We're all going.
There you go. You guys will all be working, and I'll be walking around going, look at all this stuff.
Well, in addition to all the cool stuff to look at, we've got a two-day event there called Up Next at CES, which is their attempt to put together all their media conferences in one label. And it starts on Thursday the 7th at 1 o'clock. And it's really all about some of the business models we've been talking about. We've got Stephen Chow, who used to be the head of programming for Fox, now runs wonderhow.com. And he's going to be revealing which shows and which individuals are making how much money doing their projects, both on traditional media, television and film versus broadband. And he's really going to lay out some business models. We have some top economic experts following him, such as, well, for ratings, David Poltrack from CBS and Scott Brown from Nielsen, Mike Bloxam from Ball State, talking about audience measurement and how that monetizes content. And then Tom Wolzine, Laura Martin, and Artie Balgren are going to be talking about the financial side. I don't want to go on and on about this because you can find it at cesweb.org/upnext. And we can even give you your listeners and viewers a treat. You can get in this year, at least, to both CES and the Up Next sessions for free just by going to their registration site and using the code UPN for Up Next.
And wow, that's great.
That's pretty good.
Yeah, so you want to write this down. It's cesweb.org/register. And then when you get prompted for the priority code, use UPN for Up Next.
What's the normal price?
Well, normally it would be about $200.
That's,
I think,
a great
it
deal.
goes up next week, so you want to try to do that before the weekend.
Fantastic. So definitely check that out. And I'm going to be at CES. We're going to be shooting a bunch of Mac breaks and a bunch of other stuff. So, and I know Leo is going to be doing a ton of Twit stuff from CES. So there'll be a lot of coverage that's kind of floating around. Are you recording the sessions that you guys are doing with Up Next?
We are, and we're going to stream them after the fact, it looks like, with Stick'em, which is a great group to work with. We are also going to be turning some of them into podcasts, which are also available on that Up Next information site. We have about 6 or 7 podcasts with interviews with people ranging from Vivi Ziegler, who heads digital programming at NBC, and Tommy Schlamme, the award-winning producer-director from West Wing and Studio 60, and has a new project at ABC now with Matthew Perry and a whole bunch of other people.
Fantastic. Any other any other shows, Tim?
Nat P, also in Vegas the end of January. I think Daisy will be there, and I'll be there as well. Arthur, you're going to be there?
I'm going to attend, yeah.
I'm missing that one. Shira, are you going?
I'm still on the fence. I might be there, probably.
I think I'm going to be on
I do stop-ins, you know.
I'm going to be somewhere in Africa, I think. So I'm going to miss that one. I'm going to be on the wrong side of the world. And then of course Macworld has been moved, which is pretty exciting for I've never been to CES. The reason is because Macworld and CES were always the same week, and I had to make a choice, and I always felt like I made the right one. And so, but now I don't have to choose. And so I'm going to get to go to CES and then also to Macworld. So Macworld's coming up, I think it's second week of February. And, I know we're going to be doing a lot of stuff from the show floor and doing a lot of coverage there too. Is there any that I'm missing, Tim? Is there any other ones that are coming up? I'm sure there are.
Those are the important ones.
Yep. One of the tricky things is 2 years ago, if you'll recall, Apple upstaged CES by unveiling the iPhone at a private event. And this year they seem to be doing the same thing to NatBe, because it looks like that's when they're going to be announcing the iSlate, if that's in fact what it ends up being called, at the end of January. And of course they're not going to be at Macworld this year, which is going to give a whole new focus to Macworld.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting. I'm trying to restrain myself from talking about the iSlate until it actually gets released.
Sure.
You know, or at least the week of when it's supposed to be released. I guess it's supposed to be January 26th is the rumor, I guess. But yeah, it could be pretty exciting for folks in our business. So it'll be interesting to see. Tim, where can people find you?
You can find me at onetimstreet.com.
And Shira, where can people find you?
Let's go to shiralazar.com.
Excellent. Well, everyone's so easy.
I know.
And Arthur, where can people find you?
Well, my picture is still in many post offices, but aside from that, you can write to me at arthur@greenwaldmedia.com and, of course, at cesweb.org/upnext.
Great. Thank you all. This mess that you've been listening to is This Week in Media. We are over and out.